Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Washington, D.C., it's Quintessential Listening, Poetry Online Radio. QLPOR, as it's widely known, features a bevy of poets, spoken word artists, and live poetry readings with best-selling authors. Your host is Dr. Michael Anthony Ingram.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first podcast episode of 2023. Happy New Year. I wish you good health and that your life never runs out of happiness. My first guest tonight is acclaimed and award-winning poet Mary Gilliland. Mary is the author of two award-winning collections, The Ruin-Walled Castle Garden in 2020 and The Devil's Fool in 2022. Her poems have been anthologized in many journals and other publications. You see, I could go on and on about Mary because I'm so excited for her to be here. You know how I am. But instead, let's talk to Mary. Mary, hello. You're on the air.
Oh, hello, Michael. It's wonderful to be here. Happy New Year to everyone.
That's fantastic. The crowd can always tell when I'm happy, Mary. They can always tell when I'm happy. So let's begin this poetic journey. Mary, okay. What is poetry? Talk to me.
Well, I consider that poetry integrates the spiritual and the secular, and it's through our voice because if you think about it, speech is the bridge between the body and the mind. Even literally, the throat, where is the throat? It's between the head and the heart. And so it mediates those two things, our intelligence and our caring. It's sort of a core principle of life, at least for me.
Talk more about it being a core principle of life, poetry. Tell me more. I like that. Tell me more.
One of the very first things that happens, and say parents are waiting for with a little infant, is, of course, like, when does it see through its eyes? You know, the eyes are open, but it takes a while for the baby to see. But another thing then they wait and they wait is, what is the first word going to be? When is the child going to talk? And so this is a fulfillment, I believe, of our embodiment as human beings is this speech that we learn from others and that we pass along to others. And poetry is a very crystallized, or shall I say a distilled form of speech. It is a container. A poem is like a container for a precious moment or a precious thought.
All right. Well, with all you know about poetry, and it sounds like you know a lot, why is it important, Mary? Talk to me. Why is it important?
I would say that poetry frees us not from time, but from the bondage of time and from the bondage of self. An event or a person that's written about, a poem's written about, is customarily it's in the past, but a poem will fully bring that moment to life or bring that thought to life, and so the moment itself becomes kind of vertically integrated with many a moment, past and present, and it relates to many a moment that other people have experienced. And therefore, it serves almost as a glimmer of eternity, of sharing our time and our space with the great before and the great after and the great beyond.
Wow. Beautifully stated. I was so struck by bondage of self, bondage of time. And I mixed up the order. That to me was incredible. I always sent chills to my body that you escape from those things. Bondage is such a huge word.
It
has so many connotations.
It does. It does.
You know, you've written a book, The Devil's Fool. Tell me, what inspired your book?
Oh, well, I freely admit that when people ask, what does the title mean?
Yes, that was my next question.
Yes, you can be included.
Okay, all right, thank you.
I am certainly included. But I don't know, in some sense, it's like the whole of creation is included. Because what we expect doesn't often or usually come to pass. I can't talk about it as a full-blown inspiration for the whole book. I don't sit down. There are some poets, they decide, I'll write a book about this, and it'll be this long, and it'll go this way. But I concentrate poem by poem. And when I'm making a poem, I'm completely like with that poem. And then it's when I, you know, spread them all out and I ask them, well, which of you are talking to the other ones? And then, wow. And then I find a way to make a collection. And so in this collection, I would say I managed to write about love and about death and about the changing of the seasons. Those are the three cliched topics, you know, for lyric poems. But I also wrote about, say, the complexity and the conflicts within long-term relationships. And I write a good many poems about alcoholism. Somewhere in the middle of the book, there are a number of poems that are set in Scotland. And the reason for that is that, well, I lived in Scotland for a month during a disease of cattle called the foot and mouth epidemic. And it was horrifying. And the government response, the policies were horrifying too. And anyway, it inspired all sorts of reflections in me, and it inspired a few of the poems in the book. But no, there's a poem about mushrooms. There's a poem about you'll be hearing some of these poems.
okay, I like that. But I want to ask you though about that title, The Devil's Fool. I mean, yes. that's a striking. What makes us the devil's fools? That's what I want to know.
We often compromise to get one thing. We give up another. We watch individuals and whole countries going against their own values. We are totally able to be a peacemaking species. And what is the most endemic plague on this earth? It's war. What is the greatest cause of climate change? It's military doings, you know? So, you know, it's sort of my, they asked Mahatma Gandhi, what would you think of Western civilization? What do you think of it? And he said, oh, I think it would be a good idea. You know? So this is a little bit of my take on that civilization. The earlier chapbook of mine, The Ruined Walled Castle Garden, that's another image for the whole bit, you know, sort of what we have done.
All right. Please share with me the titles of five of the poems in the book, just five poems, randomly choose five poems.
Okay. Wild Celery. Another title is Going Places.
Mm-hmm.
There's another, it's called Lit with Radiance. Number four, Holy Island. Five. This will be a short one. Dionysus.
Oh, wow. What about those titles? Tell me about the titling process. Are titles important to you? Should a poem have a title?
I usually do have a title to the poems. I know it's entirely possible to write a book with the untitled poems, but it's the title of a poem comes to me at any given time in the process. I mean, it could be early, it could be very, very late. I've had drafts of poems where the poem was kind of finished on the page, and then you see all my little scrawls next to it, and it's about, you know, 12 or 17 different possible titles, you know? So, Holy Island, that's actually the name of a place over in Britain. It's an informal name for a place, you know. Wild Celery is because the poem is actually about the nourishment of wild celery as opposed to processed celery. Yeah.
Wow. You know, the cover of your book is very interesting. Talk about the process of creating the cover.
Oh, I did not create the cover. Mm-hmm. And this is so interesting because you hear all these almost horror stories about what happened with the cover of my book, because, you know, mm-hmm. usually the author doesn't have any input on the cover. On my chapbook, The Ruined Walled Castle Garden, I asked if the press could get the Durer etching or engraving, or the Albrecht Durer, and they said, oh, probably not. But the Morgan Library said, yes, go ahead and use it. So I'm glad I spoke up there. But yes. I was silent about the Devil's Tools. I was silent. I didn't know what would happen. I had seen mm-hmm. other books the press had done, and I was impressed with them. And so when I saw this cover, I knew that the designer that had done these graphics had actually read the poems. Mm. And something interesting about the cover, the book is so well made that the illustration on the cover continues all the way on the inside of the cover. And then as you start to look at the copyright page and the table of contents pages, the illustrations go on, and they're different each time. And it's this wild sea, this stormy place
wow.
with outcroppings, you know. And mm-hmm. there's a good bit of sea imagery in some of the poems. But I just want to see if I can find the book's epigraph before
yes.
the book starts. There's an epigraph, and this is from the poet Christopher Smart. He mm-hmm. lived in England. Oh, I'm not always good on these things. It might have been in the 1600s, 1700s. He's a very interesting poet, but this is just one line from one of his poems. And it's this. It says this: "For in my nature, I quested for beauty, but God has sent me to sea for pearls."
Wow.
This book of mine developed over many years. It was actually a finalist in these anonymous national poetry contests for 21 years.
Mm.
I can only tell this to you, Michael.
Yes.
Don't tell it to anyone else.
No one else is listening. Literally, no one else is listening.
Okay. You could say of me, she persisted, you see, and I did.
Yes.
And sometimes some of the poems in the manuscript, I changed them. I changed the order of the poems. But I always had this epigraph from Christopher Smart. This was always guiding me somehow in how do I put this book together. For in my nature, I quested for beauty, but God has sent me to sea for pearls.
You know, I'm going to ask you a number of questions about your book as we continue this journey. But one question before you share, what
yes.
did you learn about yourself writing this book?
I learned in the very final revision of the book that I did, I softened it. And in all of the striving poetry circles of the poets that are trying to get their book published, mm-hmm. you always hear the advice, you should always take out the weaker poems and put in stronger poems and make it stronger and stronger. And mm-hmm. I decided to please myself. And so I took out poems, some of the poems I liked best, and they mm-hmm. were the strong, very strong poems. And I put in softer poems, you know, poems that really would, you know, be more about relationship, or they wouldn't be something like, as soon as a person reads it, they go, oh, wow, you know, they might just go, ah, mm-hmm. yeah. So I learned that I could have that, that part of me be part mm-hmm. of my public self in this book.
All right. You know, so you were willing to compromise in a sense.
I was. Yes. I'm a great compromiser, aren't I?
It sounds like, yes, you are. Yes, you are. And I commend you for it. Please share a poem.
Okay. Okay. If you don't mind, I will start with a list poem. Now, lists that work poetically, I call them litanies. And also some of the earliest surviving poems in our English language, back that we couldn't even read it, Anglo-Saxon, they're charms. They would be charms to make a swarm of bees fly away, you know, something like that. And I intend this poem, it's called Intermittent Pipe. So I'm using my pan pipes, but they stop and start. Intermittent Pipe is intended to work like a charm to cut through attachment. So when you hear this poem, you'll hear lots of everyday objects and lots of creatures, and you'll hear about diseases and goodnesses and of habits of thought and behavior, all kinds of stuff. And the poem is kind of, it's like a plea or a prayer to detach from all these things and these events and behavior. At the same time, the poem in its own way praises all of them too.
Right.
So, Intermittent Pipe. Cutworm, aphid, weevil, earwig, let go your fruit, your fondnesses, your friends. Dial tone, click, unexpected knock, voice override. Let go your agenda, your hoarse throat, your interruption. Sun, clear air, warm earth, let go your habitation, your namesakes, your flag. Button, tatting, pocket, dart, pleat, let go your edger, your embroidery. Wisdom, order, peace, heart, let go your hampers. Clarity, thoroughness, goodwill, let go your holding back. Fan belt, cylinder, regulator, winch, let go your alternator. Katydid, mantis, soldier bug, lady beetle, let go your sawfly, your leaf roller, melon worm, measles, egg, plague, melanoma, let go your bathroom, grocery, your druggist, white clover, hairy vetch, buckwheat, spring oat, let go your summer cover. Give up your hair, your nail, nipple, elbow, key, awl, Allen wrench, ice pick, hanger. Give up your worship, your worry, workload, world. Cloverleaf, rotary, roundabout. Let go your going. Heat wave, snow squall, typhoon, sirocco. Dry your hair. Sten gun, repeater, tank, stripes, grenade. Sing your ballad, your sources, your harmonics. Fly on your lace wing, curl in your welkin. Bridge, dike, aqueduct, rampart. Let go your rain, your levee, patrol. Thank you. That's the end of that poem. I just want to say the last line, Reign is spelled R-E-I-G-N, you know, right. Like a queen or king, let go of that. Yes. Yeah.
That was an epic piece, Mary, an epic piece.
Thank
tell
you.
Tell me about an experience, an early experience in your life. Let's go back in time. That you learned that poetic language had power.
All right. when I was in grade school, we had these little blue books. They might have been called grammar books. We learned they were hardcover blue books. We learned vocabulary. We learned how to diagram sentences, and we learned to memorize poems that were these verses, da-da-da-da-da-da, they rhymed and all of that, and we memorized these and we recited them. When I was a great reader as a child, getting my own books out of the library, and I might have been about 11 or 12, and I discovered Walt Whitman, and his poems and his lines didn't resemble those that I had, you know, been brought up on at all. They could just speak person to person, and they could just go anywhere. And so that was an experience for me inside. And I remember somewhere I have a little notebook where I would keep verses I wrote as a child. And I remember writing one that I just let the lines, each line be as long as it wanted. And I think because I had, you know, read Whitman.
Mm-hmm. All right. Please share another poem.
Oh, well, all right.
I want to hear more.
Okay. Okay. I'll read a poem. It's named She Wanted My Heart the Same Way. And you mentioned anthologies that my poems have been in. And so besides being in The Devil's Fools, this is also in the anthology Rumors, Secrets, and Lies. And that was created in just a few months in late summer. And it was published in November by Nhinga Press. It's a little press in Florida. And there's 116 American poets in this book, Rumors, Secrets, and Lies. The press was concerned about the erosion of women's rights and kind of, you know, women's rights being under threat. And so that's why they put this anthology together. And I'd like to read this poem for all the older girls in large families, like myself and like my sister Helen, who were responsible for raising their younger siblings, and also for all the mothers who have many children. The title has heart in it, and one meaning of the hearts of the poem is the heart-shaped earrings that the speaker is wearing as she speaks about her mother.
All right.
Yeah, here goes. She wanted my heart the same way. She once said of the boys, their equipment is exposed, such a vulnerable way to go through life. She tumbled me the way the waves do sea stones, me, then 9 others, 8 of us full term. Brim of her womb, I sit wearing her ultimate hat, rainable, sunnable, crushable, still like new. The table, silvered wood, bench damp. The line for fried sweet dough, not getting any shorter. A child paws rhinestone at the tide line. 3 in diapers, and me, tall enough to help. The rhythm of that house was frantic. Tripping on, pulling, red wagons, plastic cups. Her emeried nails, they were mother's, I can't help it, lined up my earlobes, notched opal studs. With a stroller at a crosswalk, there was my pebble of a voice. Mm-hmm. Wait, little ones, until the light changes. Thank you.
That's beautiful. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds like you take a deep dive into very thoughtful issues. And what I want to know is a poem letting your guard down or building a wall?
Oh, if a poem's going to be true for me, there can't be any guard wall, any guardrail for me. I don't write poems that just say what I think, you know, just in sentences like prose. I write with a lot of images, I guess you've noticed, just in these two poems, you know, but I use those images in order to reach people. Everyone has watched the breakers come in and then the rhinestones at the tide line. You know, I never thought of it as rhinestone before until I was writing this poem, for example. Yes. But it captures that beauty, you know, and there is jewelry in the poem later when my mother, you know, twists those earrings. So it goes, you know, in the poem. So.
All right.
All right.
You know, I want to know, as a writer, this is in general, what does writing do to you as a thinker?
Somewhere, oh, I wish I had the name of the writer that said this. How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
Oh, wow. Say that again. Say that again, Mary. Say it one more time.
How do I know what I think until I see what I say?
Wow.
For me, that's great. True, Michael, because I don't know what's coming when I write a poem. When I begin a poem, this poem that I just read, it began as something much, much shorter, you know, but it always had that theme about the hearts in it and the earrings, you know. I start a poem because I get a line in my head, you know, or I hear some words and it's like, well, what is this? What does this go with? And
Well, do you take time to reflect on each poem that you've written? You said earlier that poems talk to you in a sense.
Oh, yeah.
So you're talking back to them. So do you take time after you've written the poem to just, I guess, to breathe, to reflect on what you've written on the paper before you turn it in to someone?
Yes, definitely. And I will often keep it on where I'm sitting to write. You know, I'll keep that poem. And I might look at the same one day after day, like fresh in the morning. And I read it out loud, not loud, you know, but you can audibly, you know.
Yes.
So because the sound is essential for me in the poetry. And so I reflect on it because I'm partly trying to strike out any false notes, anything insincere. Another thing, and this is where our ears are very helpful if we have the time to read out loud. If I'm reading and for four or five words, I just go a little faster. I notice this and I might be going faster because that's not so very good. Or maybe that doesn't need to be in there, you know? And so what has happened is there's this articulation between the senses. I write by hand. I use tools, you know, pens and pencils and different whatever on paper. And I, of course, am using my eyes, but the mouth and the ear are a really crucial part of hooking up the whole person. And that's what I'm looking for. Is this poem whole in the sense that I feel whole reading it?
Very nice. Please share a poem.
Okay. I will just now, I think I want to turn to a poem from my chapbook that came out in 2020. This book is called The Ruined Walled Castle Garden. And the poem is takes place just on an island near New Orleans. And there's a historical figure mentioned in the poem, someone I read about in a magazine. Her name was Emma Meal, and she survived a 19th century hurricane that hit New Orleans. The title is a transcendently beautiful place not to be ours? The sea bangs about and sweeps out half the earth of Ile Dernière with half its 1856 summer residents. Chance combinations of genes or plans based on the weather consign personal fate to probability. How many can rise to the side of the saints and float among the rocks in a white dress? Shifting winds sweep Emma Meal back in. Little bags for keeping miracles streak her cheeks, lumps of fool's gold. On the last barrier island, entranced, shivering beneath the doctor's stethoscope, Emma fever dreams. The gray clod across the marsh channels, erodes with each storm strike. In the century after steam, then the century after flight, mortals will rebuild, sight rocks to float among. Thank you.
Wow.
That's the end.
You know, writing can be very emotionally draining, and it can be a very stressful pursuit. Do you have any tips for aspiring writers in terms of maintaining?
Well, be prepared to skip all those parties.
That's probably a big one.
It is a big one. When you're, because I'm so glad you brought this whole question up, Michael. It's tiring. I had a 7-month fellowship to write poetry in Provincetown, Massachusetts, right on the ocean. And I was almost 40 years old during this time. I turned 40 there. And for the first time in my life, poetry was my job. And I was tired after a few hours of it in the morning. And I would go lie down on the bed, or I would go out for a walk or something. And I thought, well, gee, no wonder I can't get very far trying to write poetry when I'm teaching full time. And I'm, you know, so my real point, and I'm so grateful to the Fine Arts Work Center for my Stanley Kunitz Fellowship. It changed my life, you know, but I really learned that teaching is work, gardening is work, cooking is work, poetry writing is work. And what most writers are doing is we're living a life like everybody else lives a life. I mean, we have to fix the toilet. We have to – all those things. But then we also have this just about full-time life of the spirit and of articulating words. And I didn't skip all the parties till I was, you know, in my 40s, but I skipped them without guilt now. That's what it is, because I'm tired, you know.
Yes. It can be a draining process. It really can be.
It really
because
can.
In many poems, your emotions are involved. Sometimes you're putting words on paper that you've never put on paper before about issues that have affected your life. Let's take a brief break, Mary, and we'll be right back, okay?
Okay.
All right. We are back. I am Michael Anthony Ingram. I'm here with Mary Gilliland. Mary.
Michael.
All great writers have great writing influences. Who are some of yours, and what makes them great in your eyes?
Well, do you want now or then?
Whatever you'd like to share.
Okay. As a young person, I was an iconoclast. I didn't look back. I didn't want to read anybody like Christopher Smart, anybody old or whatever, anybody long gone.
Mm-hmm.
With one exception, I would say one exception. I was fascinated with all of the earliest writing, like what was in Anglo-Saxon and mythology, you know, all those things. But I was very inspired by contemporary American poets, particularly who were writing at the time I was in college. And this would be Adrian Rich and Denise Levertov primarily, and also Gary Snyder and Allen Ginsberg, Leroy Jones, Diane DePrima, the whole cluster of people. In fact, instead of going to school in poetry, I had a lucky break. Karma or destiny brought me to a wild party after a reading that Gary Snyder gave. And my husband-to-be and I got invited to go live out on his land in California. So I apprenticed in poetry by learning carpentry and Buddhism and how to live without electricity, all those things. So I was very much looking around at the moment, you know, and what was current and who were, Adrienne Rich was a very great on feminist issues. Denise Levertov is one of the most outspoken poets against war. I admired what they stood for, you know. Mm-hmm. Later in life, I studied Shakespeare in my 30s, and Milton I got around to reading in my 40s, and then finally in my 50s, John Donne, who is one of the most intricate and fearless and both sexy and sacred poets, I think, of all time. And you know,
that's a strong statement. That's a very strong statement.
Yeah.
You've got to tell me why. You've got to tell me why.
Why?
Yes.
I mean, it's in his poems. It's in his poems. And he had different phases of his life. He was quite a rambler early on, but then he actually became a minister later in life. He was the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral over in England.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, but that's just to, you know, speak of some, say, big blockbuster poets of the past. I read so many of the current poetry books, and there is such a fruitfulness now in poetry in this country and in other countries. And one of the wonderful things is that the U.S. is really opening more to poets mm-hmm. from other countries. I'll just mention the Lost Horse Press has a series of Ukrainian poets that they've been publishing for probably 9 or 10 years, and mm-hmm. it's face-to-page translation. Because of this terrible war, people are reading these books now. And one of the things I decided to do this year, I couldn't stop the war, but I could get the books into libraries. And so I had, there's a listserv of Slavic language librarians in different parts of the United States. And I hooked up with the person in charge of that list, and she sent around a little circular and said, look, there's this wonderful series of poets. There's 12 or more books by now of Ukraine, different individual Ukrainian poets. And Mary is encouraging you to add these to your collection. And if you need money, she has it. And so I was able to all different parts of the United States, there are libraries that now have poems by Ukrainian poets.
Yeah. Oh, so you truly practice what you preach.
Oh, do I preach?
No. No, you don't. You don't preach. That's just a saying.
Okay. The other day somebody said to me, "Oh, did you hear that those who cannot do teach, those who cannot teach preach?" And I thought, "Well, I retired from teaching. Is this my fate now?"
Well, I guess what I meant is that for you to take on a project like that, it turned out to be more than just something in your head. Like, oh, you know, I'd love to do it. I don't have time to do it. You did it. You talked about it, and you did it. So you practiced what you preached.
I did, and I did it even though I have computer skills. It took me so long. You know, somebody that knows computers could have just clicked and done it all in an hour or two. But I actually got the newest books they had put out into the Library of Congress. The librarian at the Library of Congress was one of the people that responded, and he told me that, you know, every book is supposed to have a copy in the Library of Congress, but it takes ages. It takes ages to get to D.C. I don't know why. And he said, could you please yourself supply us the most recent two? And so I did, you know, because he wanted to have them as soon as possible instead of going through the red tape that it takes to get the books cataloged.
That's incredible, Mary. That's an incredible story.
Oh.
And if no one has given you kudos for that and say congratulations and that you need to pat yourself on the back, I'm telling you that now. That is wonderful.
Can you hear me now, Michael?
Yeah. Oh, yes, I can. Yes, I can. Mary, please, careful.
Okay, well. Well, how about that wild celery? I remember you had me read some titles. Let me find wild celery. Okay. all right. This is a reflective poem, and I would say it's a reflective poem for people who might be at midlife or later. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Wild celery. Now you fear. Sorry. Now you fear joy, as though a flattened hybrid could sate appetite. Green, that was its origin, bleached nearly white. Hot-housed, plastic-bagged, will that be the meal? Or what grows in the marsh, its mud-flanged heart? Eat your peck of dirt. Your mother heard her mother say, the soup free of purity's temporary money. You've trimmed house, pruned career, composted old griefs. The first seasoning recorded was celery's bitter leaf. Your hands will lever from a final bed. Elbows angle like a flail. Where tight ribs meet on a tough stalk, your finger traces insect trails to the crease. Thank you. And I will just mention that is an actual fact. After I graduated from college, I studied plants and I studied herbs. And celery was the first herb when people were looking around for, well, how can I get my food to be a little more tasty? They used celery leaves, and that was our the original celery that has a real tang.
What do you hope readers get when they encounter your work?
I hope that readers get a fuller, larger heart of their own. You know, when they encounter their work, that there are elegies in this book, for example. I have three siblings who have gone on to, you know, leave this world. And a poem can grieve for us, you know, if we're really paying attention to the words. A poem can laugh us out loud, too. And that's really what I would hope. There are some poems that really have flashes of anger in them, so that people won't turn away from their own emotions and from their own ruins and from their own dreams and their ideals. Yeah.
Mary, does it hurt you to write poetry? If not, why not?
What would hurt about it? Well, I don't get to those parties. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean, I guess as you go inside yourself.
Yeah.
As you're talking about emotions. So does it? Yes,
okay.
That's the question.
Well, I know that there was a particular time. One of my brothers died. The first of my siblings who died, it took a long time. He was ill for a long time. And so all of the family had this years to reach some kind of acceptance that he really would be going. But the second brother, it was just 6 weeks from diagnosis till he died. And one of my friends, I exchange poems with a couple of friends. We read and give feedback on each other's work. And one of my friends would ask me, she would say, "Aren't you writing about your brother? Aren't you writing about your brother yet?" And I couldn't do it for probably 6 or 7 years till after he died.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something that And I know I wrote things down, you know, and I tried or whatever. And so I don't know if you could say that trying to do that in spite of myself was hurting me, but I couldn't get it as poetry. Yeah. And then when I was able to open up the grieving with words, it was something actually unrelated that made it possible for me to start. Smart writing about.
Tell me.
Huh?
I said you said it was something unrelated. Is there something you want to share?
Well, I could share this. This doesn't have to do with any poems I'm going to read because
That's all right.
What I wound up writing was 75 pages long in a manuscript. What I wound up writing over a period of years. You know, it takes me a long time. It takes me a long time to write a poem, but. I was visiting a small museum and I was fascinated by a huge statue. It's metal work, all these different metals, and it was very intricate. And it's called the Kingdom of the Sea, and it has a wave and it has these little sea creatures, and it's from Japan. They're all wearing little kimonos, but they have like fish head or, you know, a lobster head or something. And then there are a couple of human figures and I'm looking at it and I'm just fascinated by it. And I return to look at it another time. And then I look at the card on the wall and I find out it was made in the 19th century in Fukushima, where the nuclear meltdown was. And this was just a couple years after that meltdown. You know, maybe even the year after. And something about that, I find, now this is just a sculpture, you know, but I find the sea itself is the most powerful thing on earth, I think, you know. And so something about the wave twisting and the number of creatures that were all in this sculpture. I wished that I could show it to him. Mm. And then I saw it was made in Fukushima and what has happened in Fukushima, and our whole earth is damaged and grieving from the nuclear, you know? And well, it kind of turned me inside out.
Well, that brings up a question that I've asked over 300 times.
Oh.
Yes. There is so much happening in the world, the good, the bad, the ugly, as well as the indifferent. What I want to know is, what do you view as being the role of a poet in modern day society?
To offer our poems as a vehicle for reclaiming our attention, you know, human attention, a role of a poet. Ada Limón, she calls her radio show The Slowdown, you know, where she has, a poem on, and you need to stop and pay attention if you're going to take in a poem. And I think that that's one of the most valuable things we can do. And this goes back to what I was saying earlier about time. We can just free people. We can just take people out of time for a few minutes and out of the race, you know, and the have to and the musts and the shoulds and all those things. I might have said this earlier. I don't pick topics and then I'll write about them, but I do write about my concerns, social justice and the damage to our environment and what that's doing to the state of our health, you know, as a world, pull people in to pay attention. Oh, I had a very interesting conversation once with a biologist, and he long ago did his research in the Amazon, and he was very interested in insects and also in plants and in the medical use of plants, and he was so concerned about the Amazon being cut down. I mean, it just goes on and on how it's been cut down. And so he would go around and he would give lectures and he would show people these graphs and these statistics and this is happening. And if we don't stop, this is going to happen. And he realized after a lot of these lectures that the only way he was going to reach people was to make them love it. Mm. That the statistics and the information wasn't going to make the difference. And I think this is true. Information does not change behavior, but feeling does.
Yes.
I think that's our role. Yeah.
Mm. I'd like you to tell me about a poem that you were afraid to share or to include in a journal because of fear of possible misinterpretation. You're proud of writing it, but you're afraid to share it for possible fear of misinterpretation.
Aha. Okay. I think the circumstances for that would have to do with whether there's a person mentioned in the poem that would be really offended, you know, and not wanting, would think I got it wrong, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. So it would be a circumstance like that, I think.
Okay. I understand. What I'd like you to do, you know, I love listening to your voice.
There's
something special about the way you sound.
And what is that?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out.
I don't know.
Maybe it's because you focus on sounds.
Oh.
I don't know. It's just, is very lifted.
Well, I love your voice because it's very like the voice of one of my oldest friends.
Oh, really?
Yes, really. He really is. And the way you laugh, it's just almost like his too.
Well, I want to segue into a question then. What do you think is the relationship between your speaking voice and your written voice, if there's a relationship?
Well, the thing about the written voice is I get a chance to do it over if I want to, you know.
Okay. All right.
And I certainly have. When I'm speaking, I've always wondered how do people think before they speak? Because I hear people speak so intelligently, and it seems to me I just blurt things out, and I don't have time to think before I speak. So what is the relation between these two voices?
Because when you share it, you're communicating it. And I'm going to tell you, I've not heard you. Maybe you were blurting, but it sounded good to me. I did not pick up in you. You're just talking off the cuff.
I truly am.
I would have never said that.
So this is something that has happened to me later in life is I believe my speaking voice became more assured, you know, and audible even because I became a real poet. I mean, I always wrote poetry from the time I was 6 years old. I wrote poetry, right? When I was, say, out in Provincetown, and I had all that time away from the job, mostly away from my husband, you know, you know, family, friends. I can't remember where I started this sentence now, Michael.
That's okay.
Yeah, but well, what happened was I wanted it to become a real sure a poet who would write a piece that somebody wanted to read again almost as soon as they finished reading it the first time, you know. And once I had a number of poems like that, I believe I could, you know, my speaking voice was surer of itself.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you feel that you were meant to be a poet. Correct me if I'm wrong.
No, I was meant to be a poet. I took a lot of detours, you know. I did my share of detours and, you know, other roads. And maybe my downfall is I am endlessly curious about everything.
All right. So being a poet, what surprises you most about being a poet?
Well, this is a quiet surprise, maybe, but what surprises me is to hear from another person who has heard me read poems. If you go to my website, you can click on these little MP3s and you'll hear me reading the poems. And also, I'll just share that I like to use GarageBand and do voice distortion to match the speaker of the poem. And so on my website, it can get to be a lot of fun, you know. But if someone really lets me know what happened inside them when they read this poem, and people email me. There's a contact form on my website, and people email me about how – You know, I started reading your book, and I've only read like one or two at a time because there's so much richness there, or I want to read it again. And so that it surprises me that, first of all, that they take the time to do that, but it surprises me that I have reached my goal, you know, with to real communing. through this means of these words on a page with another soul to soul.
Well, I'm going to go back a second. I finally figured it out, what it is about your voice.
Oh, yes.
That is so special. You know, when you shared, you had the MP3s and the vocal distortions and all those things. It made me think that your voice is no longer in bondage. There's no container around your voice to hold you back from being you.
That is a wonderful image. And, you know, something that has happened, I mentioned that when I start with the words of a poem, I don't necessarily know what it's about. But also, sometimes I don't know who it's about. I don't know who's speaking. And sometimes it'll take, you know, days or months or whatever to realize, like, oh, this is not me. This is a woman who's been beat up standing outside a bar. And, you know, that's who's speaking here.
Yes.
Here, this is this man whose back aches, and the weed he's trying to get out of the garden is so many feet long, and he's disgusted. And, you know, that's not me. It's not me speaking. And so possibly my willingness to go with the unknowns like this, maybe that has done something with my voice too.
Yeah, it's possible. You know, we've reached a part of the program which is my personal favorite. I call it a mini poetry concert. So this is where you share three or four poems without interruption from me, no questions, three or four poems back to back. Are you ready here? Because you're on the stage.
I am ready. I want to read a poem called Lit with Radiance. And the structure of this poem borrows. I was raised in the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church. And one of the ways of prayer is a rosary. And the rosaries, when you recite these prayers, you're reciting what's called the mysteries. And so you can recite five joyful mysteries, and the prayers are repeated, or the sorrowful mysteries, and then there's the glorious mysteries. So it's, you know, beautified with images. So I stole the terminology for this poem of joy and sorrow and glory. And so that structures the poem. Lit with radiance. Joy oscillates to sorrow as a dolphin breathes one element to move in another. As a butterfly eats the plant's green solids when it crawls, the nectar when it's winged. Sorrow fathoms glory as a tree's roots curl irregular in shape and thickness, unsteadying the outline of its trunk. Glory rouses joy the way a mystery comes close to shadow, or a shoulder leads the knee from ground to space where curvature saddles the known universe. Joy announces sorrow in the wish to live in many countries, turn all corners, marvel at the streets, and wash them. Sorrow ambers glory inside shabby rental houses, motes of sunlight, pollen, shoes well broken in. It's winter time, and I'll read a poem that's called Winter in the Garden. When I squat to the spade base, the handle does the lifting. So I see the yellowed body in cascades of loosened earth. with the blind human movement toward the future, my pointer finger tucks the damp sack of her belly. A webbed foot rests on clods of grubs and buried eggs whose hatch will wake her. With the half mew of a cat moved from an easy chair, the toad rebukes me in her dreaming. This book is called The Devil's Fool, so I think we better bring the devil in at least once here. The devil has to make at least one appearance. So this poem is called Going Places. And if I had chosen my locale by answering the nation's classifieds, as though the soul, my only daughter, could be left behind, its yearning, a music that fate disallowed. Spring song nips from a high snag, the ending notes soft red arrows pricking the roots dusk. The devil stops with his bag of gold, wants only one thing in return. Hands in pockets, I would likely learn to thrive where circumstance set me, sea wind woven in my cloth, or desert sun. But I've raindrop on rock 30 years, the wormy old apple dropping its fruit. I'll read a poem called Dionysus. Here's a poem about a tricky figure. Dionysus has two faces. He has a bright face and a dark face. You can go for the ecstasy or the oblivion. I mentioned a plant at a certain point in this poem, boneset. It's a very strong herb, and it's actually used for fevers, even though it's called boneset. It's important for you to know as the listener that the plant boneset has white flowers. When we get to the boneset, you'll know why that's important.
All right.
Dionysus, greet me by Apollo's marble door. Meet me where Artemis drops spore. Find me in the shadows of reliefs. Find me in the narrows wide with grief. Trust me when you've outlived hell and boneset flowers black. A steady fall, your snowflake cell, my Himalayan back. Shall I do one more of those?
Yes,
I could do that.
Yes.
Holy Island. We'll go.
I'd love to hear it.
Extreme. And Holy Island is a place, it's actually called Lindisfarne. It's off the east coast, pretty close to where England and Scotland meet. And Lindisfarne is that some people may have heard of the Book of Kells. It's an illuminated gospel. It's very famous. It's very beautiful. There's just one copy. I think it's maybe in a library in Ireland. And that manuscript was actually started on the island Lindisfarne. Lindisfarne is an island some of the day, okay? It depends on the tides. And so if you're visiting there, it's wise to call the telephone number to find out when the tide comes in and goes out so that you're not there 12 hours longer than you plan to be.
Mm-hmm.
Holy Island. Am I hearing the split lods of pilgrims bent from hours on the motorway, fingering their maps, the causeway awash? Do these hands nestle in pleasure as twigs stirred by a breeze find the calm of gravity? Are lines in my palms the branches of what I have sacrificed? Twice daily, the tide hilling toward dune grass, covers the road to the mainland. Grass, clear page on a still day, a scribble when the gale blows off the sea. The Lindisfarne monks stirred pigments they ground from earth's plants and metals through the manuscript tracing Jerusalem's news, the tree, the lamb, the vine, hands cupped on thighs in a sanctuary unroofed long ago. I stand beneath a thin red arch of sandstone thumbed by wind. Miniature daisies scatter a white toehold. Sound thrums through space to this green place, this clapper in the bell wanting heaven. That's the end of my series.
All right.
All right.
You know, it also means we've reached the end of our poetic journey together. But I would like to know.
Yes?
You say writers and poets write for a myriad of reasons. Does knowing that it's out of your system thrill you, or knowing that you've finished the project thrill you?
I don't find the system satisfied until I've finished the poem.
Okay.
So,
all right.
That's truly what it's about. When it comes together, then I'm not really there anymore. I'm no longer necessary, and it's a good feeling. It's time to send it to one of my friends so that they can, you know, say, oh, great, or they can make suggestions. And I often have this illusion over and over again that the same poem is finished. And, you know, sometimes it's been finished for 5 years, but then it's refinished. and you never know, because I'm so connected with I have so many poems, but I have deep connections with them, because I might be like on a walk or in the shower and something will start going through my head, and it's like, oh, about that poem. Oh, where is that poem? You know? And it'd be, oh, finally, like the final thing comes, you know, or something.
Yes.
I wasn't expecting.
What is one thing that you believe makes your writing, your poetry, different from others?
I am relatively unschooled. I didn't do an MFA program. I'm not entirely autodidact, because a lot of my friends are poets. My husband is a very fine poet. But I think I have, what shall I say, my own vision and voice.
Okay.
And possibly a reason I never went to graduate school for poetry was I am such a mimic. I mean, if you knew me in person, I carry voices and I just do voices, you know. It's not like I'm a stand-up or anything like that.
Okay.
but I'm a natural mimic, and I feared I would be susceptible to influence, and I would write, you know, just like my heroes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't really want to do that, and so I hope I'm accurate in saying that I have a different kind of voice, you know.
Well, it's funny. I was going to share that for some reason your voice is now embedded in my brain. I don't know why. But it is. And I've never told anybody else that in all the episodes.
Okay. So You, Mary Gilliland, the earworm.
So that also makes your writing unique and different from others.
Well, thank you for what
I've never said. That.
I will take this as a compliment. So
yes,
thank you.
It is. It is. Mary, where can listeners find your work?
Oh, well, marygilliland.com. And, you know, they can see it on the website here, but I'll also spell it because it gets massacred spelling-wise in all sorts of ways. It's all one word, Mary Gilliland, GILLILAND.com. And you can find there, if you go there, the landing page is the page for the Devil's Spools. And there's buttons there, different kinds, depending on where you want to order the book from, whether you want to buy a signed copy. And from that landing page, you can click to a chat book to learn about the ruined walled castle garden. There's other really interesting stuff on my website. There's those audios that I mentioned. And most importantly, there's the contact page where you can sign up for my occasional poetry newsletter. It's not something I pester people with, but if you want to be on the email list for my newsletter, send a message through my contact page. I usually write one every 6 to 8 weeks in my have announcements or excerpts of poems or reflections about poetry, little stories, pictures. Yeah. So, yeah. And also, I'll just say the distributor for The Devil's Fools, I noticed on their page for the book, they have links where if you teach and you would like to use the book in your classroom or your course, there's a link to request an examination copy. And also, if you happen to be a media reviewer, if you do book reviews of poetry, you can request a review copy right there. I find that's a very valuable support from a distributor.
Wow. Yeah, that's very nice.
Yeah.
What's next for you creatively? Where do you go from here?
Well, I just put finishing touches on another collection.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So,
Do you sleep?
Well,
wow.
You know, I sleep very well usually.
Okay.
But honestly, when I left academia, you know, and I made a decision, and I was fairly young for retirement. I need to just be a poet. Now, it's very hard to just be a poet if you live at home anyway. But I just find that I don't know. I sleep better. I eat better. And I have my hours of the morning for my devotion, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what I plan to do next is I'm putting together yet another collection, and truly, truly would like to finish that 75-page manuscript that blossomed out of my brother's death. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I understand. I want to thank you for being my first guest of the new year.
Yeah.
Because it's so light, and I think we're going to have a good year based on what happened tonight. Your light will help others' light. It's just going to live on. That's how I view it.
That is such a wonderful, wonderful thing you said, and wonderful to hear, Michael. You are a great host, and I thank you immensely for having me on the show and making this available to so many people listening. I feel very honored to be able to read from The Devil's Fools and talk with you.
Yes, I'm happy now. I was able to calm down. My anxiety just flew out the window because it was a new show. And I just feel at peace. And I want to thank you for that.
We're all in. We're all in this together.
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. All right, then. To the listening audience, thank you for tuning in. And as I share with you every episode, let poetry ring throughout the land. Good night, everybody. Take care, Mary. Thank you so much.
Thank you, too, Michael. Take good
right.
care of yourself.
I will. Okay. You do the same. All right.
Okay.
Quintessential Bye-bye. Listening. Poetry Online Radio is available on iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. You can also check out the website at QLPOR.com.